Welcome, or maybe it's welcome back. You've checked into the Newport Storytellers podcast, and we're so happy that you have. This is episode 2 of a 6-part series of stories and music from Newport, Melbourne, Victoria, Australia, west side of the Yarra River, or Birrarung, the River of Mists. A listening adventure made possible with the support of Hobsons Bay City Council through its quick response grants. And we are your hosts, Jackie Kerrin and
Matt MacArthur. If you missed episode 1, you can find us on the Newport Fiddle and Folk Club website, nffc.org.au. Newport fosters a thriving community of musicians and storytellers who practice the art of the raconteur, the reciter of verse, the folk and fairy tale, or as we sometimes say, the said, not read, or the spoken word.
And we've learned how ephemeral the art of oral storytelling can be. So over the years, we've recorded many of the storytellers, and in the light of our lives and the lives of everyone around the world being so deeply affected by COVID-19, it feels like it's time to release some of the tales into the universe. After all, who doesn't love a story and a song? Now, Matt, before we get into it, Alan Davies, our music scout, has sent us something for this episode that I reckon we should play now. Our theme tune for this podcast is called Road to Louisburg and is written and recorded by Newportonian Bruce Williams. And, of course, we all want to know the story behind this tune. So here's Bruce in conversation with Alan to tell the story of how the tune came to be.
I'm talking today with Bruce Williams, who wrote our theme for this podcast, The Road to Louisburg. Tell us about how that tune came to be.
Well, that was a really happy time. That was 1998. I was in North Carolina, Louisburg, North Carolina. And I had arranged to interview Doc Watson, the wonderful, who was just a huge hero of mine for most of my life. And I met him. He was doing a gig there. We'd arranged everything. I met him. We did the interview. And it went really well. And at the end of it, he said, oh, look, I really enjoyed your questions. Come back and we'll just sit down after the gig and have a bit of a chat. And the gig was great. And he kept mentioning me in the gig, saying, oh, I met this lovely guy from Australia. And it was just... everything just went perfectly. And then after the gig, I went back and we sat down and had a chat. And it was just lovely. It was just lovely. And I came away from that just thinking, this is a really wonderful point in my life. This was just such a wonderful day. And I thought, I've got to write a happy little tune to commemorate that. And so that was the tune that came up with it, and it's a tribute to Doc and a tribute to just a wonderful day, a jaunty, happy little tune.
That was Bruce Williams telling the story of our theme tune, Road to Louisburg. Thank you, Bruce, for allowing Matt and I to use your tune for our theme. So what's the plan for this episode, Matt?
The plan is, as always, excellent, Jackie. We have two stories, and in between the stories, Alan has another musical treat for us from a member of the Newport Fiddle and Folk Club. And, of course, we have other delights from our audio treasure trove. And there is the lullaby to close. But before we launch into it, we promised in episode 1 to deliver something interesting about Newport in every episode. As this is episode 2, I thought we'd share a little about the Newport Power Station. After all, we've chosen to use an image of this impressive building for our podcast logo.
Well, let's give into a Matt, the Newport Power Station, in a nutshell.
Located at the mouth of the river on the west bank, the current power station is one of a series that have existed on the site since 1918. The first was a coal-fired power station built by the Victorian Railways to supply electricity for the electrification of its suburban rail system. But demand for power quickly increased, and the station was expanded in 1923 and again in 1947. However, with the construction of power stations in the Latrobe Valley, Newport's future became uncertain. Even so, there was still a need for a booster station during peak demand periods, so plans were made to replace the old coal plant and build a gas-fired peak load power station. When in 1967 these plans were made public, organised environmental and union protests kicked in and held up construction throughout the 1970s. Newport D, as it's known, was finally brought into use in 1980 and continues to generate electricity today.
In the old houses of Newport, the rafters are still thick with soot from the original power station. Old-timers speak of smog that once blanketed the western suburbs, clogging the gutters, smearing the windows, and dirtying any washing left on the line. There is a story that one day the ceiling of the Newport Hotel collapsed under the weight, thoroughly coating the bunch of fellas propping up the bar. Newport D's chimney looms over our rooftops, casting its shadow like a giant sundial, and locals express a fondness for it, sometimes calling it the friendly giant. It's 183 metres high, home to peregrines and visible for kilometres, a sight for sore eyes when flying into Melbourne after a long-haul flight. So, Matt, what have you chosen for our first story?
I've chosen a story told by Rosalind Quinn. Rosalind has been a supporter of Stories by the Fire, a regular session at the annual Newport Folk Festival. She's a storyteller and librarian based at Eltham Library, where it's not unusual for her to be found telling stories to over 100 spellbound children. And this story was recorded in the Eltham Library, and it happened like this. I'd only recently joined you for storytelling sessions in Newport, and you invited me out to this event at Eltham. I volunteered to drive, and we picked up your friend and collaborator, Sarah. And I'd never met her before, but it was an hour and a half in a building thunderstorm of just getting to know you and meeting her for the first time. And it was this magical experience. It became a real bonding, I think, for the three of us to be on that journey, even though it wasn't a huge journey to a momentous event. It felt that way because of the building thunderstorm and the gathering darkness outside. And to arrive in Eltham just on the start of dark into this warm, welcoming environment that Rosalind had generated for the story session that she ran, and then to sit and soak up the vicarious experience of other people's stories, which is always a big deal with those events for me, I went home replete and satisfied that the drive was well worth it.
I do remember it was certainly a dark and stormy night, and I remember then I also had a broken arm.
I'd forgotten that aspect.
So that, but Matt, that's another story. So before we listen to Rosalind's story, let's hear her talk about her work at Eltham Library and introduce her story. In the interest of mixing it up, rather than interviewing Rosalind, we sent her a couple of questions, and this is what she sent back to us. On your Ros.
Hello, story lovers. My name is Rosalind, and I'm recording this during very strange times. It's in lockdown, which I am spending in my little Rapunzel tower of a home overlooking the Mullumullum Creek and the Dandenong Ranges. I live here with my cat, Soren. He's my resident familiar. He's an old blind boy, but he's very chatty and opinionated, so I apologise if he interrupts. Just last week he decided that the mayor needed to hear his opinions during a Zoom meeting. So, fingers crossed. Now, Jackie and Matt have sent a list of questions, which is ideal as I tend to babble and I miss things. So here we go. Tell us about your work at Eltham Library. We know you run children's story times, but what does a Rosalind Quinn story time for the very young look like? What guides your choices in programming?
Okay, awesome question. I'm always trying to grow and adapt my sessions so they do change, but I try and make them very approachable and inclusive. I try and do a nice blend between modelling good take-home early literacy skills for the parents and also being engaging enough to the children. I'm pretty picky with stories I read or that I tell to the group, as I know the influence books can have on kids. Ugh, stumbling over my tongue. But I also like to push the boundaries of what a book is, what a story is. Does one need the other? I mean, it's all learning and communication. So food for the imagination, all that sort of thing. That being said, I don't pretend that my sessions are perfectly planned and executed. As you can tell, I trip over my tongue a lot. I would hate to try and have this perfect image of what you must do to do early literacy. I embrace the nonsense of losing count of my ducks, messing up words to nursery rhymes, getting tongue-tied. I will often stop when I get tongue-tied and pretend to untie my tongue, which is not only hilarious for the kids, but also gives me time to slow down and restructure what I was saying. You know, sometimes a dinosaur ends up in the vegetable soup song, and that's okay. I don't want sessions flawless. I want them encouraging and welcoming. I am definitely a flawed individual, and that's okay. Okay, next question. In addition to the children's story times, you also initiate special events and exhibitions. Tell us more. Oh, I do. I do. I'm very blessed with a supportive work environment. Special shout out to the amazing Wendy Costigan and the team at Eltham Library, who don't flinch when I go, hey, can I cut up this old couch and turn it into a giant dragon for the kids to decorate? Or, hey, let's run a library where you can borrow people and have a cup of coffee with them and a chat. A lot of the events I run are tied with special days, activism for disability, LGBT issues, domestic violence, anti-racism, gender equality and the like. Sometimes I call in collaborators or others to run the events, as I like to ensure that people guiding the event are part of the group being featured. I mean, nothing about us without us, right? On my locker, I've got a quote that says, be the adult you needed as a child. And I try and live by that, but also have an awful lot of fun along the way. Alrighty, next question. Outside of your day job, you've written storytelling shows for adults for festivals and large events, as well as supporting storytelling events around Melbourne. Do share. All right. I actually got my start in the 2012 Melbourne Fringe Festival, something that I was lovingly booted into by my friends. The show, Red Bird and Death, was really popular, sold out, getting some really lovely press, and wow, that sounds really vain saying it like that. But it really made me realise how much love there was for storytelling and puppetry. So I joined Storytelling Vic and started making more shows. I did the Village Festival, Firelight Festival, Fringe Share Festival, Midsummer, Fringe, cabarets, weddings, birthdays, Halloween events. I will tell a story at the opening of a tin can, if you let me. My favourite thing about performing is when the story goes on without you. You become a link in the chain, or just the starting point if it's one of my original stories. I've had people recite my poems, write versions of stories, add music, create art, and I love that. Especially when they show me when they do it. Then someone takes what they made and adds on their own flair, and then so on and so on and so on, and you just become a link in the chain, and it's wonderful. And before I get too sappy, next question. Please introduce your story and tell us where it came from. I have a confession to make. I haven't listened to this recording. It was a very stressful day at the library with all the storm causing all sorts of problems. So I fear listening to how tired I might sound, but that's the whole we are our own harshest critics thing talking, and I really hope you enjoy it. But still, this story is one of my favourites, Davy and the Fish. It's a lovely story given to me by the incredible Taffy Thomas. I was lucky enough to see him perform in his last Australian visit, and I approached him, with all praises tumbling out as eloquently as a drunk mule. Thankfully, he was very gracious, and he told me to tell the story that I love so much. So I have. I feel really blessed to have become a link in this story's chain. So I hope people listening will take it and become another link in its chain. So here it is. Davy and the Fish.
Well, do I have anyone else wanting to tell a story, or shall I finish us off? It is approaching 8 o'clock, so we'll probably finish at 8, depending on how quickly I tell the last story. And I think I'm going to rectify a mistake I made at the last Fable Nights that I went to. I was extremely tired and left out a chunk of the story, and I'm going to tell it properly now. Pardon?
Or else.
Or else. Or else. Muck it up in a whole different way. Davy hated fish. He hated the look of them with their sickly slick scales and their glossy eyes that just stared at nothing. He hated the smell of them and the way it just sunk into everything that he owned. And he hated the taste of them. Any time anyone he knew cooked him fish for dinner, it stuck to the vegetables. Now this was a problem because Davy worked on a fishing boat. And it was his job to gut the fish, and that was his entire job, was picking up the fish, cutting off the head and slicing it down the belly, and putting it to one side, picking it up, cut, put it down. And that was what he did, day in, day out, to these horrible, slimy creatures. Until one day, Davy picked up a fish, still sort of in his usual daze. This fish was different. It was beautiful. The scales had an iridescence to them. The eye was alight with a glow that just had a knowledge behind it. It didn't even smell. And he lifted his knife, because this was his job, and he held it at the belly of the fish. And then he put it down. He just couldn't kill the only fish he ever liked. So while Skipper's back was turned, he moseyed over to the side of the boat and flipped it over and watched it swim away into the water. But that skipper, he must have had eyes in the back of his head, because the skipper turned around and said, "Davy, I don't break my back day in and day out so that you can play Rex Hunt and put everything back in the water." I tell you what, if I catch you doing anything else out of order in today or any other day, you're out of a job. I've had enough. So Davy was very, very nervous because he didn't like his job, but he had bills to pay. So his knife was shaking in his hand and he picked up another fish and started gutting and he started to whistle to himself nervously. But on a ship, whistling is considered bad luck. You'll either whistle up a storm or whistle up the devil, as they say. And the problem is that the skipper caught him before either of those things happened. "Davy, I told you, you're out of job as soon as we hit port." Now, Davy couldn't help but feel a little bit relieved, the fact that he would never have to gut another fish again. And then he realised that he probably wouldn't be able to find work. So when his feet hit the pier and he started walking home, his feet were dragging. Not only did he not have a job, but he had to tell the wife. So he walked slowly down the cobblestones and, oh look, stone to kick. Anything he could do to drag his feet. And saw someone walking slowly towards him, leading a cow. It was a beautiful looking cow, lovely big brown eyes. And a stranger approached him and said, "Davy, mate, how you going?" "I'm sorry, do I know you?" "Oh, close enough, mate, close enough. Tell you what, you're out of a job, aren't you? How did you know that?" "Yeah, word gets around. I just stepped off the boat. Word gets around, Davy. But tell you what, wife's not going to be too pleased, is she?" No, but I'm sure we'll make it worth. Hasn't your wife always wanted to have a cafe? Bakery with fresh bread and tell you what, this cow here, it's a good cow. It makes the best milk. And from that you can make the best cream to make the best scones. Be a beautiful cafe with this cow, wouldn't it? Do you want it?" I don't have any money. I'm sorry. Like, I can't afford a cow. I don't even know where I put it. Oh, Davy, you're not asking for money. I'll tell you what. You take the cow, bring it back to your wife, and in a year and a day, I'll come and visit. I'll ask you 3 questions, and if you can answer those, we'll be fine. You can keep the cow. It's yours. Davy thought about this, and then... What if I can't answer the 3 questions? Oh, Davy, mate, I promise you it'll be nice and simple. Don't worry about it. Shake on it. So he shook the stranger's hand, took the cow, and started walking away. And as he looked back over his shoulder, he saw the stranger walking with his long jacket and a long pointy tail and hooves sticking out from underneath. But he had a cow. Better than not having a job, so he took it home, and his wife went from being very confused, very furious, very confused again, and then kind of happy. And the happiness increased over the whole year as they set up the cafe, and they became very popular because the milk was thick and creamy, and it made the most delicious breads, scones, coffee. And time just flew past. Davy had no idea when he was sweeping the floor just before opening on a year and a day, but time was up until a stranger pushed his way into the door. Davy tensed. The stranger approached him, walked past and sat in the corner, picked up the newspaper and started to read. Oh, thought Davy, maybe he won't come, maybe he... And in a flash of light and a strong smell of sulfur, the devil appeared right next to him. Davy, mate, year and a day. Feels like a short time, doesn't it? Are you ready for your questions? Okay. No, Davy. Are you ready for your questions? And then the gentleman in the corner folded up his newspaper, stood up. Yes, Davy is ready for his questions. And that was your first question. Devil looked furious. I'm sorry. Are you going to be answering all of his questions for him then? The gentleman smiled and said, well, yes, actually, I will be. And that is your second question. Better make the third one good. Oh, said the devil. Who the bloody hell are you anyway? Smiled and said, I am the fish that Davy set free. And he lost his job, and I'm here to help him get his money back from you. So that's your third question, and have a nice day. The devil fumed, and he ranted and raved and pulled out all of the swear words that I'm sure only teenagers know. And, well, he couldn't do anything. We disappeared in a fume. But the cafe is still there with the best coffee, the best bread, and the best scones. Thank you.
Beautiful, Roz. Thank you, thank you, thank you. How very fun was our night in the Eltham Library, drinking cups of tea and being mothered by you. Okay, Matt, quick question. At last count, how many libraries do you belong to?
I think it's 12 current memberships, and I owe fines for overdue books at 11 of those.
Yep. I think we better stop there. We don't want you saying anything that might incriminate you, yeah? I just knew it was a lot, and I wanted to hear you say it. And I also want to say a big hug and sincere thanks to all librarians, wherever you are in the world. You've raised our spirits and helped keep us on the right side of okay during this time when our lives are so impacted by COVID-19. So although we heard earlier from Alan, our musical man from the Newport Fiddle and Folk Club, we still want him to share something with us here, as this is Alan's regular designated spot in the podcast. And Matt, you and I are sticklers for the master plan. Well, sort of. This is the moment where we ask Alan to showcase a club individual or band with a focus on original or traditional material. We're now in for a treat from singer-songwriter Ellen Fish. Ellen has released 3 CDs of original songs over the last few years, and she's a regular at Newport Phil and Folk Club events. Here she is chatting with Alan Davies.
And today I'm talking to Ellen Fish, the composer and performer of the song Put Your Stone Down. Tell us about the inspiration for this song, Ellen.
This song came to me very quickly and easily. It was one, I call this one of my gift songs. I was waking up, so I half dreamt the words, and I had to quickly wake up and write them down. And the words that came to me were put your stone down and let the earth turn. And for me, not all songs happen like that, so it was really, then I was able to write the words very, very quickly. So in the outset for me, it was a personal song. So it was about me, and it was about, it felt like a lecture to myself to let go of emotional baggage that, you know, we've built up. And in doing so, just sort of walk on the earth a bit lighter, and so figuratively let the earth turn when you let go of emotional baggage. And then I've been hoping that the song is not too preachy, but I think then it's got a bit of a universal message to it, because it's, I guess, written in the direct address, put your stone down. So it's talking to the world, put your stone down and let the earth turn, even though the idea of it was initially about myself. So I'm hoping that the way that I've written it, that others then, that it's got a universal message and that others can relate to it. And the second and the third verses have a similar theme to them. Yeah, this one came to me very, very quickly and easily, and I think it's got a nice, it feels to me almost like a bit of a gospel, spiritual, country, easy listening sort of vibe to it.
One of the nice things about the song, I think, is it's got, especially towards the end, you can hear people laughing, and it's got a little bit of the vibe of being recorded in someone's backyard at a barbecue or something like that. Was that something you planned from the start, or did that just kind of come in as you went along?
It came in as I went along. It didn't initially start out like that. Often when I get into the recording studio, then along with my record producer, we'll come up with some new ideas for it. But I think it did come to me that it was the last song on a 4-song EP, and it did come to me that it'd be a really lovely song to have family and friends come in and add a bit of a vibe, which I think that really worked. So it sort of brought to it a kind of a lightness and a joy.
Put your stone down and let the earth turn. Put your stone down and let the earth turn. Don't be so afraid, 'cause there ain't no price to pay. Put your stone down and let the earth turn. Put your load down and let the earth turn. Put your load down and let the earth turn. Don't be so afraid, 'cause there ain't your load down and let the earth turn.
your stone down and let the earth turn.
How wonderful was that? That was singer-songwriter Ellen Fish with her song Put Your Stone Down. If you'd like to learn more about Ellen, purchase her music or make a booking, you can find her at ellenfish.com, and of course you will be able to find this link with the podcast notes for this episode. Please, please, please visit the Newport Fiddle and Folk Club website at nffc.org.au to find more information about Alan and all the details you need to participate in club activities, of which you will be spoiled for choice.
So, Jackie, story number two, what have you chosen?
Well, Matt, I've chosen one of your stories. We have people come along to our storytelling gatherings from all walks of life, but up to date, you're the only marine ecologist. I particularly enjoy stories that take me to places I will never go, and your stories offer me a glimpse into an underwater world of absolute wonder. We first heard this story in Newport and again at the Williamstown Literary Festival, but this version was recorded at the Moth Grand Slam at the National Theatre St Kilda in 2018.
Thanks. I'm standing beside a hole, and inside the hole it's cold and dark and there's no air. A lifelong fascination with Antarctica and a love of working underwater have collided, and I'm standing on the shores of Ross Island, about as far south as you can go and still work as a marine biologist. I take my deep breath and step into the dark, cold, airless hole and descend through 3 metres of sea ice and 12 metres of sea to begin my work on the seafloor. And my task engrosses me. I know what I'm doing. I'm calm. So long as I don't think too much about where I am and what I'm doing, I stay calm. And then I feel a current go past, and it gives me a bit of a knock. And normally when I feel that, I think shark. But I'm too far south for sharks. I'm too far south for orca. It's cool. Nothing's going to eat me. I'm probably the biggest thing nearby. And then I look up and there's a Weddell seal. I'm not the biggest thing nearby. The Weddell seal is the biggest thing nearby. 400 kilograms of seal has just swum over the top of me. Underwater, they look like a hot water cylinder, almost a perfect cylinder of blubbery meat. And they do this neat trick where they look at you over their back. I can't quite pull it off. Big, dark eyes to take advantage of what light is available. And it watches me as I watch it. And then it touches the seafloor. Now, we've brought our warmth and our oxygen to this spot by very different paths, both in terms of what we did that morning to prepare for this dive that brought us together, and in terms of the huge arc of evolutionary history that separates us all the way back to the last time our ancestors met. But the seal and I are watching each other, and I don't think the seal's watching where it's going, and it hits the seafloor. And the seafloor is covered in anchor ice. Now, we normally think of ice as floating, but anchor ice doesn't because it's anchored. Ice just forms wherever it's cold enough for ice to form, and anchor ice forms on the rocks of the seafloor. And it is buoyant, it wants to float, but it can't, until it reaches a size that it's able to loft the rock that it's attached to. So sometimes you'll get a rock drifting past in the current. Or sometimes it'll peel up like an old carpet. But in this case, it's been dislodged by the seal that wasn't watching where it was going. It was watching the monkey. Now, anchor ice forms incredibly beautiful interlocking plates and facets. They're very delicate, so as the seals hit it, this anchor ice has shattered, and under its own buoyancy, it begins to rise. And it's rising in a shaft of light. The water that the seal and I are diving in is almost optically pure. It's probably the clearest water on Earth. and you could see for kilometres if there was light to see by, but there's not. The sea ice and the snow on top of it block the light, and other than the hole that I came in through and the hole that I'm going to leave by, it's like someone's dropped a dark curtain through the water. Black velvet. You can't see a thing. Except underneath these holes where the bright sunlight of the Antarctic summer is streaming through this clear water, and these ice crystals are now rising into that shaft of light. And this beautiful coruscating chandelier starts to loft, and each facet of the ice is catching that light and splitting it and rotating as it rises. And this incredible kaleidoscope is on the rise. It's the most beautiful thing that I've ever seen. And I don't know if anyone else that can communicate with language has ever seen it. And while as a scientist you train very hard not to anthropomorphize, you're not supposed to put human values onto the organisms that you observe, it's hard not to think that the seal might have gone out of its way to show me this, that it wasn't just an accident of navigation, that it's thought to itself, hey monkey, watch this. And again, I try to be objective, I try not to anthropomorphize my experience, but it's almost impossible not to feel incredibly privileged to have shared this moment, alone, under the sea ice, but for this Weddell seal, and to feel grateful to that seal for what it showed me. Thank you.
It's a ripper of a story, Matt, from a place I will only ever visit in my imagination. Thank you. We live in a suburb laced and fringed with waterways, fresh and salt, and for many of us living in Hobson's Bay, you've become our go-to marine ecologist, and you have a service, Diver Matt Incursions, delivering workshops to schools, marine centres, etc. Can you talk to us briefly how you incorporate storytelling into your practice?
Well, storytelling is a skill that is largely left out of scientific training, or at least it was when I was passing through my scientific education. And I think that that's something that we've got to alter, because storytelling is such a deep tool for communication, and scientists have stories to tell. So encouraging people to attend storytelling circles and to listen to the voice of their favourite authors and speakers and copy them in presenting their scientific findings at conferences and in papers, I think is my push to make science part of everyday life and scientific thinking part of people's approach to solving problems in a way that goes beyond taking a guess or making an estimate. So attending storytelling sessions in Newport with you has almost been a second education, almost a, pardon me, like an apprenticeship. I've learnt so much in the time that I've been hanging out with you and the other storytellers about communicating effectively and where to find the hooks in my science that will make an effective story that will resonate with people. We are a storytelling species. We communicate through story. And it probably goes back beyond language. It's probably something from our pictures and our dances before we began to speak. So this is powerful magic.
It is magic indeed. And it's one of the things I love about the storytelling gatherings that we have in Newport and that we've continued on Zoom throughout this COVID period. It's the diversity, people telling stories from so many different backgrounds and so many different interests. Don't have to convert me. I think it's wonderful. You can learn more about Matt at his website, Diver Matt Incursions. That's divermatt, all one word, .com.au. And if I said that too quickly, yes, check out the links on our podcast page. So, Matt, we're almost done. Almost. It's lullaby time. And this month I've chosen When the Boat Comes In. Sometimes it's hard to know for sure where and when a folk song began, but this one undoubtedly comes from the northeast of England. It was first published in 1840, but the lyrics were probably written as early as 1826. It's probably the northeast's most well-known dandling song, a song to be sung while dancing your baby on your knee. And if you listen to the words, although the singer is a tad drunk, he expresses the underlying hopes of the working people that maybe one day things will improve for them all.
This recording was made especially for us by local songstress Dharma Picking and David Kidman from Yorkshire. When the Newport Storytelling and other folk club events were forced to go virtual because of COVID-19, we had an initial feeling of disappointment. But then something fabulous happened. People started connecting with us from interstate and overseas. And one of those people was David from the UK. David has been embraced by the Newport Fiddle and Folk Club and is now an honorary Newportonian. This song was recorded by David and Dharma over Zoom.
Dance to your daddy, sing to your mammy, dance to your daddy, to your mammy sing. You shall have a fishy on a little dishy, you shall have a fishy when the boat comes in.
Oh, come, my little Jackie, now I've smoked me backy, have a bit of cracky till the boat comes in. You shall have a fishy on the little dishy, you shall have a mackerel when the boat comes in.
Dance to your daddy, sing to your mammy, dance to your daddy, to your mammy sing. You shall have a fishy on a little dishy, you shall have a fishy when the boat comes in.
Here's your mother humming like a canny woman, yonder comes your father, drunk he cannot stand. You shall have a fishy on a little dishy, you shall have a herring when the boat comes in.
Dance to your daddy, sing to your mammy, dance to your daddy, to your mammy sing. You shall have a fishy on a little dishy, you shall have a fishy when the boat comes in.
Our Tommy's all as fuddling, he's so fond of ale, but he's kind to me, I hope he'll never fail. You shall have a fishy on the little dishy, you shall have a haddock when the boat comes in.
Dance to your daddy, sing to your mammy, dance to your daddy, to your mammy sing. You shall have a fishy on a little dishy, you shall have a fishy when the boat comes in.
Oh, I like a drop myself when I can get it sly. You, my bonny bairn, I like it well as I. You shall have a fishy on the little dishy. You shall have a bloater when the boat comes in.
Dance to your daddy, sing to your mammy. Dance to your daddy, to your mammy sing. You shall have a fishy on a little dishy. You shall have a fishy when the boat comes in.
Oh, may we get a drop off as we stand in need, and we'll may the keel row that brings the bairns their bread. You shall have a fishy on the little dishy, you shall have a salmon when the boat comes in.
Dance to your daddy, sing to your mammy, dance to your daddy, to your mammy sing. You shall have a fishy on a little dishy, you shall have a fishy when the boat comes in.
Thank you, David Kidman and Dharma Picking. David is a singer noted for his broad repertoire, which includes intimate, reflective songs, sea shanties, rousing chorus songs, and even songs from less overtly folk genres. He also performs themed song and verse programs. His CD, Songs Worth the Singing, is available from his website, davidkidman.co.uk. Details on our podcast page. So, this brings us to the end of episode 2 of the Newport Storytellers podcast. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to sharing more stories and music next month. It's goodbye from me, Matt MacArthur.
And me, Jackie Caron. Matt and I acknowledge that recording and editing this podcast has taken place on the traditional lands of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unbroken connection to country that has long been mapped by story, song and dance, and we pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and to the elders of all nations, and to the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders who've been listening to this podcast.
We thank the Newport Fiddle and Folk Club, under whose auspices we bloom, Hobson's Bay Library and the Williamstown Literary Festival, who have made space for our voices, and all the storytellers and musicians who have given their permission for us to share their work. Rosalind Quinn was recorded by me, and my story was recorded at the Moth Grand Slam. For more information on the music making and storytelling in Newport, and of course this podcast, visit the Folk and Fiddle Club website, nffc.com. www.ourstorytelling.org.au, where there are more groups and activities than you can poke a stick at.
This episode of the Newport Storytellers podcast was recorded while observing strict rules of social distancing, Matt in Altona and me in Newport, and it has been edited by my collaborator, Matt MacArthur. We thank Cameron Sharp for our graphic, and for our theme, Road to Lewisburg, we thank Bruce Williams.
All the people in this podcast have contributed to events produced in Newport and the city of Hobsons Bay under the banners of Storytelling Australia Victoria and the Newport Fiddle and Folk Club. Not all the storytellers live in the local area. Several travel from distant suburbs and even nearby regional towns to join us. And in this episode, it was our delight to include our friend David Kidman, zooming in from Yorkshire. And if you've enjoyed listening, please spread the word. Stories and music are for sharing.
So Matt, now no one's listening. Just tell me honestly, do you keep joining libraries because you've accrued too many fines? No, perhaps you better not. Don't say.
They always want their books back.